Hi, I'm Derek Ashong, and you are now in the stream. Today, we examine the rapid expansion of private prisons in the U.S. and the debate around the prison industrial complex. For those of you who haven't already found out on Twitter, today's my last day on the stream. I'll be talking to you a little bit more about that in just a moment. But first, our friend Azita Ardakani, founder of Love Social, is filling in as digital producer. Joining her here today on the orange couch is Paul Ashton. He is at the Justice Policy Institute. Paul, so glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, remember, you can tweet at Azita using the hashtag AJStream. She'll be getting your comments right into this conversation. We also want you to know that you can always find out more about us and how to connect with us on our About page. Just go to stream.aljazeera.com and click About. You can meet the entire team, and you can tweet any of us there using that hashtag, AJStream. Here's some of the hashtags that you've already shared with us. Today, there are over 6 million people under correctional supervision in the United States. The country also has the highest incarceration rate in the world, 760 people per 100,000. I want you to take a look at this graph, which puts it in perspective in comparison to some other nations. Only about 30% of these people incarcerated are considered to be a threat. So what about the rest? Some 60% are incarcerated for so-called soft crimes. The war on drugs, tougher sentencing policies, and immigration laws have caused a rapid expansion in the country's prison population. Last month, Pat Robertson, one of the country's most outspoken conservative leaders, had some surprising remarks about the prison boom. Let's take a look at what he had to say on the subject.
We here in America make up 5% of the world's population, but we make up 25% of jailed prisoners. We have now over 3,000, the number must be much higher than that, but over 3,000 federal crimes. And every time the liberals pass a bill, I don't care what it involves, they stick criminal sanctions on it. They don't feel that there's any way that people are going to keep a law unless they can put them in jail. And so we have the jails filled with people who are white-collar criminals. I just think it's shocking how many of these young people wind up in prison and they get turned into hardcore criminals because they have had possession of a very small amount of a controlled substance. I mean, the whole thing is crazy.
So how did the U.S. get here? In the 1970s, private companies began presenting themselves as a solution to the growing demand for incarceration facilities. Over the next decade, these businesses extended their influence by contracting with the Immigration and Naturalization Service, now known as the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, to detain undocumented immigrants. This soft privatization of correctional facilities was followed by the appearance of for-profit prisons. Since 9/11, the revenues have more than doubled. Here's a clip on explaining how that process works.
Detention of migrants is a multi-billion dollar industry.
One in which immigrants are traded like products.
They are for sale to the highest bidder.
Who benefits and who profits? Corrections Corporation of America, or CCA, the GEO Group, and the Management and Training Corporation combined own over 200 facilities in the nation.
With over 150,000 bed spaces for a total profit of close to $5 billion per year.
Private prisons profit like a hotel. The more occupants that go in, the more money comes out.
You just sell it like you're selling cars, or real estate, or hamburgers.
Now, I want to show you another graph that will also give some additional perspective. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics in Washington, D.C., between 1999 and 2010, the number of individuals held in private prisons grew by 80%. Now, if you'll just take a look at the growth in the overall prison population, that was only 18%. But if you dive deeper into the state prisons, you find that they grew by 40%. Federal private prisons grew by 784%. To put this into context, the U.S. population as a whole only grew by 12% during that same time period. Those who support the privatization of prisons say it's the most cost-effective solution. Opponents argue that it's big business turning minor offenders into hardened criminals. So which is it? Joining us today is Charlie Dattar, co-founder of Between the Bars. He's also a PhD student at MIT Media Lab. Also with us is Harris Kenny, policy analyst at The Reason Foundation. Welcome both of you to the stream. Charlie, I want to begin with you. What do you believe is at the root of the rise in these private facilities over the last decade or so?
Well, it's sort of a strange, perverse mixture of corporate power and the police state. I mean, you have businesses that are just trying to make money, but when they want to make money imprisoning people, they have to do that by lobbying the government, by getting tougher laws passed and that sort of thing. We saw that happen in Arizona recently with the passage of the HB 1070, that tough immigration law. Some private prisons were major lobbyists to help get that passed. I mean, one of the CCA contract requirements that was in a recent proposal they had was an assurance by the state that it has sufficient inmate population to maintain a minimum 90% occupancy rate over the term of the contract. So it's really these companies are trying to get more people in prison because that's what makes them make more money.
Okay, and Harris, now, isn't that a fundamentally undermining premise or dynamic for American society?
I think the concern here, and by the way, thanks for having me on.
Pleasure.
I think the concern here is legitimate. It's saying, is there an incentive structure where people benefit from other people being in jail? And that system is in place, and that system is run by the government. 92% of federal and state inmates are held in public facilities. And I like to think of it sort of like a bathtub. If the correctional system is a bathtub, the spigot is what puts those inmates in there in the first place. And it's government legislators that are passing the sentencing laws that are putting these people here in the first place. And there's been decades of tough on crime legislation that is politically very popular, both cranking down on illegal immigrants. Last year, President Obama deported more immigrants than any other president in 1 year in American history. Republicans and Democrats unite in the war on drugs. And you can go down the line. So I agree with the problem, but I think the people that are benefiting are the public sector, because 92% of the system is run by the government.
That's a very interesting comment, and I want to get our audience directly involved because they've had a lot to say. Azita?
Yeah, Dana from Alabama has sent in a video on anti-immigration.
My name is Dana Farhan, and I'm speaking from Alabama. A state that has passed the toughest anti-immigrant law in the nation. I think that we need to start the conversation about reforming a broken immigration system instead of passing anti-immigrant laws that are enabling corrupt corporations such as CCA and GEO to make profit over incarcerating people.
Okay, so Paul, I mean, what do you think, how do you respond between what Harris has pointed out, which is that there are public officials that benefit from this, and the point that Dana is bringing up?
I would say, you know, it is a good point that Harris brings up, but I mean, that the fact is that in 2010, CCA and GEO, the two largest private prison companies, made nearly $3 billion in revenue. And so the idea that you are gonna privatize putting people behind bars only incentivizes making more money for these industries instead of trying to divert people from the justice system and working to eliminate the number of people we have in prison.
Okay, this is an interesting point because we're having a tweet that's directly related.
This is perfect because Lily Layer 4 tweeted in, when removing a person's freedom brings profit to another, it will always be abused to the detriment of what is right and just.
Charlie, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I would quote John Mahaffey, who's one of the bloggers for Between the Bars, writing from prison. He says, business has no place in the imprisonment of humans. Humans should not be considered objects of storage to charge a fee for. What happened to rehabilitation, second chances, or even Christian forgiveness? It's all giving way for the Corrections Investment Initiative. That's what they're calling it.
Wow. So, Harris, let's dive a little bit deeper into the point you were raising about the public sector. You know, as we were doing our research, we were looking at the state of California. And the state of California, since, I guess, 1980, has built one college campus. In that same time, it's built 21 prisons. A few years ago, a three-judge panel, a federal panel, ordered the state of California to radically cut its prison population due to overcrowding. I mean, isn't the incentive structure creating a problem that is actually breaking the back of public sector budgets.
Yes, I agree. The incentives are, you're right, the incentives are totally messed up. But California is a perfect example. California, when the Supreme Court ruled in that Brown v. Plata case, it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. At that time, the California prisons were at double capacity. In some prisons, there were inmates that were crammed, hundreds of inmates, into gymnasiums, sleeping on double bunk bed cots. Now, the interesting thing about California is that the privately operated prisons were fine. They didn't violate the Constitution. It was the publicly operated prisons that violated mental and physical health conditions for inmates. And the state comptroller found that the three highest paid employees in the state of California were public employees. They all made over $700,000 in 2010, and they all worked for the Department of Corrections.
But let me just jump in on that point, because I lived in the state of California. I'm familiar with some of those issues that you bring up. There was one particular locality, very small locality in particular, where you were seeing some of those trends of high payment for certain individuals. But what we're really looking at is the fact that there's a $5 billion a year private prison system. And don't the incentives that are created within that system mean that you've got people who have a lot of money and who have a vested interest in lobbying, or otherwise some would say purchasing influence with public officials, to make sure that more money goes to building and expanding private prisons?
Sure. Well, my response to that is twofold. First, like I said, only 8% of federal and state prisons are operated by the private sector. And so one can throw out seven-figure numbers about the size of these companies. But if you think that 92% of the prisons and at the state and federal level are actually operated by the government, you'd realize that the numbers are much more staggering as far as how the government benefits. And I'll give you an example of that. In Fort Lyon, Colorado, a state correctional facility closed. And the city hired a lobbyist. It was a public facility, public prison. The city hired a lobbyist and sent that lobbyist to Washington, D.C. and asked, and is still working, to try to fill that prison up. In New York, Governor Cuomo has multiple state prisons that are empty but fully staffed. And he's trying to close these public prisons, and the legislature won't let him. So there's state after state examples where the government has incentives and the government has money on the line that they refuse to let go.
So, Paul, I mean, is it government itself that is to blame for this?
I'm not going to say that government isn't a problem either. The JPI's perspective is that we need to reduce the number of people in prison wholesale. And that means investing in the front end, so investing in education, substance use and mental health treatments in communities, and employment services and job training, so that people are diverted from involvement in the justice system in the first place. You know, to go along with that, I would say, you know, the private prison industry spent $17 million over the past 10 years to lobby the federal government alone. Mm-hmm. So this industry, you know, spends tremendous money trying to influence, you know, both people in the halls of Congress as well as state legislatures to enact policies that help to benefit them by keeping people in prison, keeping them there longer, and having them come back.
Azita, let's get more from our community.
Yeah, so Ben Connors from San Francisco sent in somebody in California prisons, actually.
Hi, my name is Adan Falcon. I am a student over San Francisco State University, a former employee of a nonprofit that used to interview inmates over at the San Francisco County Jail, and a member of the Occupy SFSU group. Spending in California for prisons has increased tenfold, making it number one in the country, as opposed to education, which has been lowest amongst in the country in terms of spending and the quality. The state needs to increase its investment in education as opposed to prisons.
Okay, and Charlie, let's bring this to you, and I want to add on to that, especially speaking of California, you have the three strikes rule, which actually means that if a person has been convicted three times, they have mandatory sentencing. So you're forcing people into significant prison terms that don't necessarily or may not have committed significant crimes, frankly. What are your thoughts on the comment?
I mean, yeah, so I mean, I think I'd agree that it's not just the private prisons that are a problem. The main problem is just the rate of incarceration that we have. And the fact that we aren't treating the people that are being incarcerated as human. I mean, we aren't listening to them. I mean, in this conversation here, we could have some folks calling in from prison on the line, but we aren't paying attention to them and the cost that they're having as much.
Okay, and but let me push back for just a second, because
yeah, sure.
One of the issues that people will raise is the idea of security. I mean, everybody wants to feel safe, and the public is determining that, hey, we want strong law and order. They seem to keep electing people who are passing these kinds of policies, aren't we getting what the public wants?
Well, everybody loses when we isolate people. If we cut people off from all communication, we're not only hurting them, but we're also punishing poor families, communities, and taxpayers. We need to really start listening to the families who are hurting as, you know, they're struggling to try to get their dad a job when he comes home after he missed out on years of education and experience. If we react against a crime when it happens by trying to isolate someone and completely desocialize them, in the end, that helps no one.
Paul, what do you say to the families of people who have been victims of crime and who say that we need to keep our streets safe, whatever it takes?
I would say I agree. I think public safety is important. But what research and what some of the most prominent criminologists in the country say is that incarceration doesn't work as part of promoting public safety. That we should work on reintegrating people back into society. We should work on these programs that we know can help reduce recidivism, evidence-based models that keep people out of prison. I mean, prison itself has huge collateral consequences that come with it. And arrest has huge collateral consequences that come with it that can have devastating impacts on people and their families and communities. And so I think our goal should be to reduce the number of people in prison, reduce the number of people who have contact with the justice system.
Azita?
I was just wondering what systems are working well? Like what countries would you refer to? I know the UK is well known as one that we go to, but are there any others?
I would argue that the UK has its own challenges as well.
Right.
They are in the midst of having a lot going on with privatization there as well. You know, some places, I think that in Finding Directions, a JPI report that kind of examines the US criminal justice system versus some other Western democracies, I would say, you know, look at places like Germany that uses day fines to keep people out of jail and prison. And Finland has one of the highest rates of police contact with their population, but one of the lowest incarcerated populations.
That's so interesting. And I'm going to jump to a tweet where we hear, America needs to focus more on the internal crisis and less on waging wars outside its shores. So it feels like, you know, America's priorities in terms of this as a focus are not high on the list.
Well, I actually want to riff on that, because if you go back to this chart that we showed earlier, Paul was just mentioning United Kingdom and Germany. And we see that in the UK, it's 153 people incarcerated per 100,000. In Germany, it's less significantly. It's 90% or 90 per 100,000. In the United States, it's 760 per 100,000. Harris, to the point that's just been raised about our internal issues, aren't we undermining our own competitiveness and possibility in the world when we're taking such a massive percentage of our population and incarcerating them when other countries simply aren't? Are Americans that much more violent than people elsewhere?
Well, I think the concern is spot on. And the fact is, it's a cultural problem. It's culturally popular, and people laugh in television shows and movies when someone goes to jail for something that they supposedly deserve, and then they're sexually assaulted in jail. I mean, it's kind of an ongoing joke in popular culture in the United States. I mean, I think it's perverse, frankly, and I think that we are spending too much. But the fact is that the private sector has served as a relief valve. It's the public sector that's opened the spigot. It's the public sector, it's like elected officials that are putting these people in jail. And it's interesting that one of the other guests was critical of the United Kingdom because they're actually doing exactly what he's talking about, which is alternative systems that would reward keeping people out of jail, and they're doing it through privatization.
Once again, I mean, do you not acknowledge that there must be some influence from the millions of dollars that are spent by private prisons in lobbying these very public officials you're challenging?
I think that money has an influence. I think the public sector has a lot more money on the line. The public sector also controls these contracts. And at the end of the day,
but you could argue the public sector controls every contract. I mean, the public sector controls grants for offshore drilling and all kinds of things. That doesn't stop oil companies from lobbying for that, or natural gas companies from lobbying for expansions of hydraulic fracturing. Fundamentally, does not the private prison industry have some culpability in this expansion because they are helping to fund it?
No, I do not think you can say they have culpability. Yes, they do have representation, sure. And yes, do they advocate for that? Absolutely. But where are you drawing the line? Because if one says that operating prisons, that's too much. Well, the private sector also provides food that is used to feed these inmates. The private sector provides commodities that's used to build jail cells. Private sector provides uniforms that houses the inmates and that the inmates wear, right? So at what point do you say that no money can be involved? Because clearly the public and the private sector are making money off this incarceration.
So let me go to Charlie. I'm just going to want to get Charlie's thoughts on that because he works with prisoners. I mean, Charlie, somebody is having a job for making sure those prisoners are fed, housed, and clothed. If you got rid of these prisons, what happens to those people?
It's true. I mean, there are a lot of people that are employed right now. I think some statistic I heard was around 1 million people are employed in the prison system. And if the prison system went away right now, that's, 3.5 million people now that would need to find a job. There's a poem that one of our writers at Between the Bars sent in. This is Robert Outman. It says, saying to a mother's tears and sob, suck it up, lady, I'm just doing my job. After all, I've got a wife and kids to be fed. Take your complaint to the department head. And so it's really a lot of people that are involved and tied up in this system. I think it's right. It's not just the private system. That said, the private prison system does have some unique differences that separate it from the public prison system. Unlike the governments, private prisons get to pick and choose who they take. So people with serious medical problems or other needs that cost a lot, private prisons often don't take those. They also tend to operate where it's cheapest. So there's a private prison in Colorado that's housing prisoners from Alaska. And that means if somebody wants to visit their loved one who's incarcerated down in Colorado, they have to fly thousands of miles, then drive out to a rural area. And in some cases, like in Arizona, people are starting to get charged just to visit their family. There are really a lot of problems here, and the private prison system is exacerbating.
So, Paul, I'm glad that he brought up Arizona because there was a lot of controversy prior to the Alabama immigration law that was recently passed. The Arizona immigration law caused a lot of stir around the country. And what people started to find as he did more research is that a lot of the lobbying for that law came from the private prison industry. Mm-hmm. What's the relationship between the prison system and legislators actually focusing on laws regarding immigration?
That's a good question. You know, one of the things that we talk about in JPI's report, Gaming the System, is kind of how the private prison industry has used their political influence. We term what we call a triangle of private political influence. So the idea is, with the goal being more people in prison and ultimately making more money for the private sector. And the way they achieve that goal is through campaign donations, so giving directly to campaigns, through lobbying, hiring lobbyists to represent their talking points in the halls of legislatures, and then building relationships and associations. In terms of the issues in Arizona, you know, it falls into a couple camps. Actually, it falls into all of them, truth be told, because, you know, the people in the state legislature receive donations directly from CCA, as well as the relationship associations. One of the things we talk about is their connection to ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council. You know, NPR did a great piece on that, talking about how ALEC had a hand in passing SB 1070. And ultimately, mm-hmm. at the time, you know, CCA was
that's the Arizona law that's yes. been so controversial.
The Arizona law. And we do know that there were lobbyists for both CCA and GU who are on the ground in Arizona.
So I want to stop you there because we're going to get deeper into that conversation in the post show. I want to thank you. But first, actually, I want to let you know that between now and the next time you're thinking about this, Al Jazeera is going to have a special program on Fault Lines highlighting this. Be sure to catch it next Tuesday, April 10th at 22:30 GMT. They're going to look at the links between immigration policy and the for-profit prison industry. You got to see it. Thank you, Paul, Chris, and Harris for being here. And thank you, Azita, for getting our community involved. As I mentioned in the beginning, this is my final day on the stream. This is my last broadcast here. I've got to say this has been an incredible experience, and I want to give particular kudos to all the people behind the scenes. You might see me here wearing a nice shirt. You'll see Azita. We've got a lot to say. There's a team of people that make this possible who are among the best in the industry. We set out last year to do something that was groundbreaking, and we have literally together made history. I want to thank all of you for being a part of it. This conversation is not over. You can keep in touch with me at www.derekashung.com. For now, go to stream.aljazeera.com to continue this conversation on the prison industrial complex. Tweet us using the hashtag AJStream. As always, we'll see you on there. Hi, welcome back. We're in the post show. We want to continue our conversation on the prison industrial complex. And we were talking a little bit about immigration policy, and you brought up the issue of SB 1070 in Arizona, Paul. Just continue your thoughts on that.
What I was talking about was the fact that that example fits perfectly into our triangle of private prison political influence. I was talking about ALEC, but another piece was that both CCA and GEO had lobbyists who were pushing for that bill on the ground in Arizona. You know, there's a...
Okay, so I wanted to come into a tweet that we just got in. It says, from at the Sunova Beach, how it got to this point? Capitalism. Outsourcing has become a culture all over the world. End result, someone is making money. Harris, I mean, you mentioned that there's a cultural issue here. Could it be the culture that, you know, of the almighty dollar, that perhaps this is just another industry that people think is just as legitimate, but perhaps it has more negative externalities than others?
I think the cultural problem is the problem that people think the state has authority over people's lives to the extent that there's almost no line. I mean, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, nonviolent drug offenders and non-citizens, as some people call illegal immigrants, constitute huge numbers of these prisons. And Reason Foundation, we support drug legalization and open immigration policy. So I think the cultural problem is that the state has the authority over individuals to tell them what borders they can cross. The state has authority over individuals to tell them if they want to consume a substance that the state deems unhealthy, that they can do that. And if the individual doesn't comply, the state has the authority and the power to rip them from their family and lock them away. So I think I think that's the cultural problem. It's failure to respect the dignity of the individual, you know, rather than profits.
This is a really interesting point, Charlie, that Harris has brought up, particularly as he mentions the dignity of an individual. We saw a Supreme Court ruling on Monday that basically gives law enforcement the ability to strip search people who are arrested and sent to a jail facility, to strip search them, irrespective of whether there's any grounds to believe that they may be carrying a controlled substance or a dangerous weapon. It came about because of a man in New Jersey who had been in a car with his wife driving, his child in the back. They were pulled over. Turns out that the man had an outstanding warrant, or at least the computer thought he did so. He had paid the fine for the ticket, and that warrant was never removed from the system. He's taken to jail. He's strip searched. He's moved to another jail, strip searched again, incarcerated for a week, and then they let him go because he hadn't done anything. Supreme Court said, yes, that's okay. Is there something more fundamentally problematic here?
Well, yeah, so it's endemic to the system. I mean, a lot of prisons by policy refer to people as offenders. And so they're sort of trying to push in this idea that as soon as you've been incarcerated, you are a different class of individuals. We're constructing this underclass. And so at the root of it, there's this lack of humanity that you're seeing shines through with that kind of a policy. I mean, one of our writers was complaining that he was recently told that he couldn't have any art supplies in his cell because his art was seditious. And he had to look that up in a dictionary, but he was amused. He couldn't possibly believe how his art could be considered seditious or could sabotage the world's largest government somehow. But there's just this sense that
this gentleman, just for clarity, he's already incarcerated, and they're saying that his art is dangerous.
That's right.
Okay. All right, well, that puts things in perspective. Azita, I know we've got more coming in from our community. What are you seeing?
We do. Alexander on Google Plus said to us, the democratic state should have complete monopoly on violence. It is up to the population to elect the right people to wield this incredible power, and the checks and balances of the government need to be protected and respected. I guess there, what can general citizens do? This feels like it's rather way too large and outside of the individual's control, or something we should be participating, but what would the first step be? What do you think?
I think the first step is getting informed.
Right.
You know, there's so many people I still talk to today who don't realize there are such things as private prisons in this country. And so I think actually learning about the criminal justice system, learning the fact that we spend over $70 billion a year keep people in prison in this country. Which could be used for education, exactly. Or, you know, having substance use and mental health treatment in the community so that we're not putting people who have substance abuse and health issues in jail.
Mm-hmm. Here's another tweet coming in from at Lily Layer 4. Says, we citizens need to think again about the role and principle of government from the ground up. Harris, I think you've been getting at this issue to some degree, but is it realistic? I mean, as many people as are incarcerated in this society, it's a relatively small fraction of the population. And not only that, but you have felon disenfranchisement, where in many states, if you've been convicted of a felony, you can't vote. So is there any real hope that people who don't have a tangible relationship with the prison system, or who those who do have not got a voice in the political system, is there any hope that this can be changed?
I think there is. And I'm confident that it lies at the root of an important message, which I said earlier, is that the dignity of every human individual matters. And if you believe that, and if citizens around the world can believe that and really ingrain that into how they vote and how they live their lives, then the prison system matters to them, because the people that are in that system are individuals. And there's actually a lot of exciting things happening in the United States. One thing that's been failed to mention so far is that in 2010, the federal and state prison population dropped for the first time in decades. Now, it was by less than 1%, but it still dropped, it crested. So it's possible that we may have reached a peak here. And some reforms include increasing the amount of substances that one can hold without receiving heavier fines, creating a separate sentencing grid for individuals that have nonviolent drug offenses. In New York State, they're looking at a close-to-home initiative where juvenile offenders will be kept closer to their homes in New York City rather than sent to state juvenile facilities in upstate New York, and they're going to be closing down hundreds of beds. So there are tangible steps that are happening right now that people are motivated to support politicians that do that, and so I think it's going to be incremental. It's not going to happen overnight.
Charlie, I want to bring up another aspect that we haven't discussed yet, but because you work with prisoners, we know that a disproportionate number of the prisoners in the American prisons are Black and Hispanic, a much higher percentage than they represent in the general population. Is there a racial aspect to the delivery of justice in this country?
Well, there definitely is, yeah. I mean, 1 in 3 Black men will be incarcerated at some point during their lifetime. It's really just kind of an extraordinarily high rate. It's impossible to ignore. I mean, as the Trayvon Martin case is pointing out, there's just a very deep-rooted racism that impacts a lot of people in this country.
And, you know, you were speaking earlier, Paul, about the idea of education. I mean, aren't we already being educated? Aren't we being educated, in fact, that a person who looks like X is a potential offender?
Unfortunately, yes. Racial profiling, you know, it unfortunately does happen. But I think that, you know, we need to make a more concerted effort to end racial profiling, of course, but also to invest, as I've, you know, said repeatedly, in services in the communities that help to eliminate the need for people to be involved in the justice system.
Okay, so one other thing. Let me push back on that a little
sure,
bit. Just because, let's say you do invest in those things.
Sure.
Somebody is benefiting from the status quo, whether it's the private prisons mm-hmm. or whether it's public officials, as Harris has mentioned, whether it's whatever aspects of our society that see that this kind of massive growth, a growth in our prison population that exceeds the growth in our general population, someone is benefiting. When you go to say to those people, hey, I want to educate more kids in poor communities, what happens? What response do you get from those who would prefer for things to stay as they are?
I mean, right now, I think, to be cynical for a moment, I think they say, yes, we agree, and then they do nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's. I think, fundamentally, who wants to argue about educating kids? Right? Mm-hmm. It's more so about being able to actually do it and putting the money where your mouth is, which I think we don't see policymakers making that concerted effort.
Azita?
We have a tweet in regards to the three strikes law, which I know we've covered a little bit, but Der Blethend says, the most pernicious, unjust legislation going is it affects mostly nonviolent offenders. And I think this goes back to the idea of creating this underground society where you have separate classes, and that's really a huge issue, that the system has been set up to put nonviolent offenders in the same place, and then they might come out much more violent than they started in the first place. Is there anything that can remedy that kind of problem?
I would argue not putting nonviolent offenders in prison, mm-hmm. Having diversionary programs or programs that, you know, work with them in their local communities that can help them keep them engaged in with their families and communities and mm-hmm. help them, you know, reduce the amount of recidivism.
Because it's a stepping process.
So on that front of recidivism, Charlie, the people that you work with at Behind the Bars, you guys basically provide an outlet for them to have their voices heard in the public. Do you find that people who you work with leave prison and maybe through their interaction or the process that you or the projects you've engaged in, they don't come back? Or are you finding that these are people who are with you for a lifetime.
Well, we're pretty young still. So, I mean, we've only been operating for about a year. There are several people who had been bloggers for us that have been released, but not enough to make any sort of statistical declaration over whether we're working yet. But we are operating on the theory that basically by giving people better communication outlets and the ability to keep in touch with their families, to form weak tie social networks that can help you get jobs, by doing all that sort of stuff, we hope that we will be contributing to healthier communities and stronger performance when people get out. I mean, the structure is kind of stacked against you when you're in prison for communicating with your friends and family. In a lot of prisons, there are monopoly contracts with phone services to provide the phone service inside a prison. In some cases, it can cost as much as $15 for a half an hour local call. So really, your ability to communicate can be severely curtailed. And when that happens, you're not going to be able to get a job as easily. You don't have friends of friends who can help hook you up with something.
Well, just speaking of people who have been in prison and have been able to communicate somehow, we've gotten this tweet from @CreoleTalk. I hope you mentioned the plight of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was a journalist who was convicted of shooting a police officer in the Philadelphia area. He's been in prison for decades. It's in the Storify. You can look at storify.com/AJStream to get more information on that story. But ultimately, we find that some voices are escaping the prison system. We hope that conversations like this will get regular people to rethink the way it's structured. I want to thank all of you, Charlie, Harris, Paul. Thank you so much. Azita, it's been a pleasure working
Likewise.
With you. So great having you here this week. I want to thank you once again, our community, for making this such a pleasure. It's been an honor to work with all of you, as well as our entire team at AJ Stream. Tweet me at Ashong. Tweet us at AJ Stream. It's been a pleasure. See you online. We'll be right back.